This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we speak with a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer who just lost his job after 44 years at the Chicago Sun-Times. But first, speaking of jobs, the latest figures are out from the Department of Labor. The U.S. economy added 175,000 jobs last month. That's the good news. The bad news is the unemployment rate rose to 7.6%. How does that math work? We're going to talk about that. Also, it's June. That means it's graduation season, and we'll find out what kind of jobs new graduates can find or can't find. I'm joined once again by Marilyn Giewack. She's a senior business editor here at NPR, and also with us, The Wall Street Journal's Sudeep Reddy. Thank you both for being here.
Hi. Hi. Great to be with you.
First, Sudeep, let's do this math here. How do we add nearly 200,000 jobs and see the unemployment figures rise?
It's a curious issue, but this is actually a case where bad news is actually good news. The unemployment rate rose in the latest month because a lot more people came into the labor force. Over the course of the recovery, which is now about 4 years old since we came out of the recession, we've seen a lot of people dropping out of the labor force. They've been giving up hope. Those people don't count as unemployed once they leave the labor force. Now they're starting to see signs of economic recovery. They're coming back in. If that continues, you may actually see the unemployment rate go up a little bit more before it comes down. But overall, that's a good thing if you're adding jobs at the same time and if you see those payroll numbers increasing month over month.
Okay, so on the balance, is this jobs report, in your opinion, Sudeep, good or bad?
It is relatively good. We're still in a very slow recovery. It's about the pace of the recovery we've seen for the last two or three years. So that's still troubling that we haven't really taken off the way a lot of people hope we would. It's been a choppy recovery, lots of ups and downs, lots of volatility. But when you look across an entire year, we've been remarkably steady. And that's what's kind of hard to realize is to see a steady recovery despite all of the anxiety we've had over the last couple of years is kind of remarkable, and we'll look back at that and see that we continue to gain month over month.
So far, the Dow certainly likes the jobs report. Marilyn, what do you think? Do you agree with Sudeep that this is on balance a good report?
You know, when we think back how the year looked back in January, looking ahead, we know we had higher taxes. There was a deal cut in Congress in December, and that raised taxes on the wealthy. It also took away that payroll tax holiday that we were enjoying. So everybody saw a chunk of their paycheck disappear. And then, of course, there was the whole congressional battle over spending, where scores of billions of dollars have been cut from the budget. And a lot of people thought that process that we called sequestration would really squash the economy. So, you know, we came into this year with a whole lot of weights on our shoulders, and yet we still seem to be chugging along. So I guess you'd have to count that as not great, but pretty good.
Well, is it different depending on your age? I mean, we've heard for a long time that this recession has been particularly hard on young people, recent grads. Obviously, it's graduation season. You mentioned in a piece that you wrote for NPR.org that the unemployment rate for people under 25 is much higher than the general
yes.
population. So how is that outlook now?
All of these things are sort of relative, but this year we're seeing a better job prospects than we have in the last 3 or 4 years. It's been a long, bad recession. It's been a slow recovery. So the survey showed that jobs are better, and especially for college graduates, the offers for pay for beginning workers are up about 5% overall. So that's pretty good. But still, we have a tremendous problem with youth unemployment. A lot of young people just can't get started in this economy. You know, it's sort of on either end of the age spectrum. If you're an older worker, it can be pretty tough to find a job. But if you're in that younger category, it's also tough unless you have the right skills. And I think that's really what we're seeing in this job market is that if you've picked the right careers, things that are like engineering, computers, health sciences, you're doing pretty well. But if you're just a generic young person sort of kicking around looking for some kind of work to get started, it's a lot tougher.
And we know, Sudeep, that it's also uneven for those who are African-American or Latino who've been hit disproportionately hard. What sectors are hiring? Are there jobs like Marilyn is talking about that are good for people who are having trouble finding work?
There are some jobs that are good for people. If you're a college graduate, things are actually not that bad. College graduates, the unemployment rate is about 3.8% right now. If you don't have even a high school diploma, it's over 11%. So there's a huge disparity based on education, and that's making a big difference. People who don't have the highest education are obviously having the toughest time, and those folks who are finding jobs are finding them in parts of the service sector that might not be paying as well. Hospitality hospitality, restaurants, retail trade, temp workers. A lot of people obviously are very happy to have a job these days if they can get one, but these are not paths that are really going to take people up into the middle class very quickly, and that's one of our troubles throughout the recovery.
And I wanted to say something about that figure for college graduates. You may know a young person who has graduated from college and they're not very happy with their job, and you hear 3.8% unemployment. Gosh, shouldn't they just be grabbing up jobs? But a lot of what's happened with that is they're sort of underemployed. They have a college graduate degree.
But they're working,
you know, part-time, or maybe they're working in retail. They'd like to be a buyer flying off around the world and doing something exciting.
Well,
but
gee,
actually,
who wouldn't want to do that?
Right. But the reality is they're standing there, you know, stocking shelves in a retail job. And that makes that low educational person in a tougher spot. That's why so hard for a person who is a high school dropout. Actually, you might be very good, a really good worker who would do a perfectly fine job in a retail store. But you can't get that job because you're competing with someone with a college degree.
And this shows us why these numbers are only numbers, and how we have to really look over several years to see how the kinds of jobs people are getting, to make sure they're getting the right ones to fit their skills.
Always trying to make us take the, or economic reporters make us take the long view. That's Sudeep Reddy, covers economics for the Wall Street Journal, and Marilyn Gwax is senior business editor with NPR. They both join me here in our DC studios. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Throughout the entertainment industry, you can find alumni of a tiny high school program who were building sets in Hollywood, mixing sound on Broadway, and performing on TV shows, including The Office. They're graduates of the Addison Repertory Theater, or ART. The program is a kind of incubator for actors and theater technicians in Middlebury, Vermont. Julie Burstein went to see what makes ART so effective.
When students at Addison Repertory Theater talk about the program, a common thread quickly emerges.
If I had been forced to be into the box that the administration of my ascending high school had wanted to put me in, I would not be a successful person. Definitely not. No.
I don't think I would have graduated high school if I hadn't come to ART.
ART program director Steve Small knows how hard it can be to imagine a future when you struggle in high school. Small studied auto mechanics at the Hannaford Career Center, though it was called the VOC then, for vocational school. After graduation, he worked on cars and in his family's orchard. He spent time in the Army, and then he headed to the University of North Carolina School of the Arts to pursue his passion for acting. A visiting professor gave Small some advice.
And he said, you know what, Steve? He says, you're going to work your way into this business. And my initial internal response was, I don't want to work my way into the business. I want to be discovered. But he's absolutely right. I've been working my way through this business.
Steve Small crafted a successful career. He built sets on Broadway. He welded the chandelier for the movie Edward Scissorhands. He even acted in a few television shows. After moving back to Vermont, Small started the theater tech program at ART, because he knew his students would be able to get jobs.
You're not always going to be the star on the stage. You're sometimes going to be painting sets or hacking into some wood and building a platform or something, or maybe running lights.
Megan Patton has been in ART since the middle of her sophomore year, when she played Wendy in Peter Pan. Students at ART spend 2 hours a day practicing theater crafts in the morning or acting in the afternoon. And academics are woven into everything. The students analyze the plays they perform and sometimes compose their bios in iambic pentameter. Just a few days before their final show this spring, in ART's Black Box Theater near the welding lab, students were still painting sets and flubbing their lines. As opening night loomed, stage manager Bowen Abbey stayed remarkably calm.
If I was a hot mess right now, then I feel like that would translate to the rest of the cast. And it's very important that I, you know, try to keep a calm, in control demeanor.
Bowen and five other students piled into a van last February to drive to New York City with Steve Small. They were headed for the Unifieds, where performing arts colleges from across the country audition regional high school talent. Small has a ritual to combat nerves. Every year, the night before the auditions, he and his students hike to the middle of the Brooklyn Bridge, where kids perform their monologues, accompanied by frigid gusts of wind and roaring traffic.
And I say, cumulus! I say, a cumulonimbus!
The next morning, Small works the hallways, getting kids into auditions without reservations, chatting up administrators, showing his students how to network. All six ART students received offers of admission to their top choice colleges.
We're looking to see if I fit a walk-in.
This is where Cami goes.
ART graduate Cami Shishko just completed her freshman year at Cornish School of the Arts in Seattle. When she decided to enroll in ART in high school, her guidance counselor told her she wouldn't get into college if she studied theater.
He wanted me to take a bunch of AP classes and all this. He thought that I was not using my full potential, and I'm really glad I didn't listen to him.
Her first year at ART, Cami created the costume for Peter Pan. Small says the costume nearly stopped the show because a thread caught in Peter's flying harness when he was fighting Captain Hook.
He's on a double harness and one released, so all of a sudden, instead of doing flip sideways, he starts spinning around by one pickup point. The rigging just went all the way up through the whole thing.
I felt horrible about it. And Candace was just like, meh, it's a learning experience. It happened. And then she fixed it.
Candace Burkle was the co-founder of ART, an English teacher whose vibrant creative spirit infuses the program. Peter Pan was her last show. She died in 2011. Students tear up when they talk about her, and one, Chenoa Small, wore her teacher's dress to her audition for Luck. Chenoa is Steve Small's daughter, and studying with her father in ART was sometimes complicated, but acting offers a place to turn emotions into art. Chenoa chose to audition with this monologue from Brighton Beach Memoirs because it gave her a place for her grief after Candace Burkle died.
Then I found his coat in Mom's closet, and I put my hand in the pocket, and it had been emptied and dry cleaned, and it felt cold, and that's when I knew he was dead.
In the fall, Chenoa Small is headed to the theater program at Northern Illinois University, along with Megan Patton.
It's funny that the first show I did was Peter Pan, and it's about not wanting to grow up and stay a child forever. I was very young, and I feel like I'm coming out older and wiser, and I'm making the decision to grow up and to be something incredible. I hope.
In the black box of ART, young actors and technicians learn to create something out of nothing, to build entire worlds out of wood and fabric and words, to imagine themselves into the future. For NPR News, I'm Julie Burstein.
When President Obama first took office, he promoted an idea called the Social Innovation Fund.
We're going to use this fund to find the most promising nonprofits in America.
Nonprofits, he said, that are good at solving social problems. The plan was to give them money so they could grow and spread their ideas. So far, the fund has handed out $138 million to 200 groups. As NPR's Pam Fessler reports, the benefits to taxpayers are not yet clear.
The point of all this social innovation is people like Jasmine Chestnut, 20 years old, vulnerable, struggling in school, but smart enough to know when she needed help.
Once my family found out about my grades, they cut me off completely. I came home for Thanksgiving. I didn't have nowhere to stay. I didn't have any money. I didn't really know what I was going to do.
She was a college freshman in Miami, her first time away from a troubled Washington, D.C. home. No father, sick mother, relatives who didn't seem to want her.
All I had at that point in time was Ms. Bradley, that she was the only adult that I had.
My name is Zebenisa Bradley, College Support Advisor with the KIPP D.C. KIPP Through College Office.
Bradley's job is to help disadvantaged students succeed. Jasmine Chestnut had been in the KIPP charter school system since middle school. Now they were trying to guide her on that next step, through college. Bradley suspected Chestnut was having trouble when she stopped returning her calls.
So then one day I got a call, and it was like, Ms. Seb, you should sit down for this.
Turns out things had spiraled out of control. Chestnut was failing her courses, in debt, and lost. And her family wouldn't pay for her to come home. Eventually, Bradley flew to Miami, helped the college freshman pack up her things, return to D.C., and figure out what next.
She thought, I'm done with college.
So here's where the innovation part comes in. KIPP DC is part of something called Youth Connect, created with money from President Obama's Social Innovation Fund. It's a coalition of six nonprofits that work with troubled D.C. youth. So Bradley called one of the other partners, Year Up, which helps students train for technology jobs, and Jasmine Chestnut loved technology.
We were like, okay, we cannot allow this passion to diminish.
So, long story short, Chestnut joined Year Up, got A's in all her classes, and is now interning at a Washington think tank with counseling and housing help from another Youth Connect partner.
Once I got in, I kind of like regained my focus as far as my education goes, and now I'm here.
Given the right supports and the right investments for these young people, they can excel.
Mark Schindler is with Venture Philanthropy Partners, which set up Youth Connect using social innovation funds and private donations. He says they know the kids they deal with have too many problems for any one group to solve.
And so we challenged ourselves and them to come together around a table and figure out ways that we could do more together than we could individually.
Just the kind of thing the Social Innovation Fund, also known as SIF, is looking for. Pooled resources, shared ideas in areas like education, job training, healthcare. Youth Connect is also looking at the best way to measure success. Another big part of the fund, getting results you can wrap your hands around, like a business. Sounds good, but some critics say they're not really seeing those results.
I don't think SIF has sparked a great deal of social innovation, and I don't think SIF knows what social innovation is.
Paul Light is a public policy professor at NYU and served on a review panel for the fund. He thinks that some of the nonprofits involved, like KIPP, do really good work, but he says the government has yet to show that the Social Innovation Fund has had much impact, other than to boast that it served 174,000 people in 2 years.
Congress and the president should not care how many people walk through the front door of these many projects. They should care what happened to those people and whether they walked out the front door again with a job or a better quality of life.
Wendy Spencer agrees that results are crucial. She's CEO of the Corporation for National and Community Service, the federal agency that runs the fund. She says one accomplishment is that the fund has attracted $350 million in private matching funds to help the nonprofits do their work. She says the plan for the coming year is to study what it means.
How has it really changed lives? How has it changed communities? And have these nonprofits really been able to thrive and scale? Could they have done it without us?
Important questions as Congress considers whether to provide more money. As for Jasmine Chestnut, her advisor says there's no doubt the young woman's chances of success have improved, but it could be years before they know how much. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Now, as the school year winds down across the country, we'd like to turn to some good news in education. High school graduation rates are at a 40-year high. Across the country, 75% of students are earning a high school diploma. That's up from 66% just 10 years ago, according to a new report by Education Week. And some of the biggest gains come from Latino and African American students who are finishing high school at the highest rates ever. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called Chris Swanson. He's the Vice President of Editorial Projects in Education. That's a nonprofit group that published this new report together with Education Week. He's here in Washington, D.C. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
For additional perspective, we've also called Michaela Ron, who founded LearningWorks. That's a charter school dedicated to helping some of those kids who weren't making it across the finish line, who were, in fact, dropping out in the Los Angeles area. She's with us from member station KPCC in Pasadena. Michaela, welcome to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris, I'm going to start with you. What's going on here? Why do we see high school graduation rates growing?
We've been looking at this issue in Diplomas Count, our report, for about 8 years now. And as you've already mentioned, we've seen a really strong rise over this period of time. And this starts at a period maybe about 10 years ago when the issue of graduation dropout was not even on the national agenda, which is kind of a strange thing to think about at this point in time. A lot of what's behind these increases we're seeing and the consistency across groups is really the consistent focus over the past decade on this as an important issue, educationally, as well as how it feeds into the economy.
Are there specific supports that have been put into place, or do you think it's just more of a kind of a talking it up, like a bully pulpit type of situation?
You know, it's a little bit of both. And I think one of the things that we've come to realize through research and reform that's been going on the ground is one of the big challenges that school systems face is understanding what their challenge is. Students who have dropped out, who are at risk of dropping out, are very different from one another and are very different from one community to another. Before, say, the past 10 years, school systems had surprisingly little hard data and information about their students, especially ones who had already left. And so a first step being understanding what the needs of your students are. Do you have an overage at-risk population, or these students who are just, you know, struggling academically in general? Once schools and school systems can get their heads around that, then they can think about matchmaking the needs of their students to the solutions that are going to work best for them.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about new news about the high school graduation rate in the United States. It is at a 40-year high. We're talking about this with Chris Swanson. He's Vice President of Editorial Projects in Education. He published this new information. Also with us, Michaela Ron, who founded LearningWorks. That's a charter school dedicated to helping kids finish school who have previously dropped out. The rates for Latinos increased by 5.4% from 2009 to 2010, and they increased 3.3% for African Americans for the same period. Still, around 1 million students nationwide are not graduating on time this graduation season. So, Michael, what have you observed about why kids are dropping out, and what kinds of things tend to help them make it across the finish line?
One of the concepts in prevention is, yes, awareness helps and higher expectations in schools help. And that helps the graduation rate, meaning students who might be floundering at the school, getting the D's and the F's or hanging out on the benches or the attendance, those are the ones we can quickly grab if the adults are paying attention and get them to the stage. And that increases the graduation rate. I think an interesting concept in the report that we're talking about is the epicenters, where there are high dropout rates that still exist. And I work in one of those epicenters. And in those cases, dropouts need a different strategy. In our program, it's completely structured different, and the students aren't required to be there all the time. They come for what they need. And so I think it's important to look at graduation rate and dropout rate separately, and they require different interventions. One's more of a prevention strategy, and one's more of an intervention strategy.
To your point, what the report talks about is, as you said, epicenters where the graduation rate is either dropping or staying the same. LA is one, Chicago is one, Denver, Dallas, Albuquerque, New Mexico is one. Chris, why don't you pick up the thread here? Why do we think this is? I mean, these are urban systems. There's a lot of turnover in a lot of these systems. Maybe there's a lot of churning in the student population. Maybe there's a lot of kind of people coming and going. A lot of times there are a lot of immigrant groups there too. Maybe English isn't the first language. I mean, what are some of the factors that you're seeing here?
Those are all factors that you see a lot. And when you look at this epicenter list, these are school systems that are large and have low graduation rates, and that's what gets you on the list. And so New York, Los Angeles, you know, the big urban districts tend to be the ones that pop up, even if there's larger districts elsewhere in the country. And it is, I think, what we see in especially kind of big city districts that have histories of low performance. It's a combination of factors that all comes down in the same place. Our public schools are reflections of the communities they serve. These are often communities that have high rates of poverty, histories of segregation, histories of low-performing schools. They may be well-resourced or not, but, you know, the dollars aren't everything. Students who are in these communities, and often they don't have the good kind of family or neighborhood supports that, you know, affluent suburbs would have, these epicenters. There's lots of challenges. There's progress being made. New York is, you know, at the top of the list. It's also by far the largest district in the country. They've been making steady improvements. And so even if you're on the list, it doesn't mean that good things can't be happening. But the bar is very high in terms of the level of challenge.
But Michael, I still want to push you on the sort of question of the kinds of things that you think work here. And you make a point of intervening before kids drop out and also recovering the kids who have already dropped out. And you're saying that you need different strategies here. So let's talk first about the kids before they drop out. What are the kinds of things that you see work?
The area that everybody needs to be focusing on is middle school and ninth grade. When you look at a ninth grade transcript, you really know the story. You know if they're UC bound in California, they're going off to Harvard, or if they're in the average pack or if they're struggling to graduate or if they're going to be a dropout. I mean, I see transcripts that have straight Fs all the way through ninth grade and they have zero credits. So the prevention student is the one that's hanging on, and the intervention student isn't even hanging on. The schools really need to look at that data early on to make determinations of what's going on with these students, and most of it is correlated to poverty. And so how can we put the supports in place to make sure these students are attending and getting the engaging teachers? Because it also comes down to relationship. If there is no relationship or reason for that student to be at school, they won't be there.
And the recoverable youth is kind of a terrible term, isn't it? I mean, it sounds like recycling. But I understand that the intention of it is that maybe the kid's already dropped out, but you can get him or her back in. So, Michael, talk a little bit about what are the strategies that you find working there. Well, one of the things you were telling us earlier is just the traditional school day is a non-starter for this population. Why is that?
Imagine a student who's been out of school for 6 to 8 months. They've been on their couch. They had no one getting them off the couch. There was no parental push. Sometimes the parents don't even know that they are a dropout. The schools aren't calling you. They're not coming to find you. If you decide to get off that couch and go back to school, you are not going to go back to school 3 to 6 hours a day into continuation school. You've lost all your habits. And so we've created a school that's very alternative in that students come like a college to the credits and activities that they need in order to graduate. And the more that they feel the relationship and see the success that they have, the more hours they put in. And by towards graduation, they're there 40 hours plus a week.
Overall, though, we've presented this as good news. Is it? I mean, there are still a million kids dropping out every year in an economy that increasingly requires a lot more education than high school. So Chris, you know, final thought, how should we feel about this? Is this a good news story?
It's good news, but I think we should not sit back and rest on our laurels. There are still a million kids a year who are not earning diplomas. That's not enough. And as we've seen the graduation rate increase, the demands for highly educated people in the economy just increase and increase and increase. And it's not just that people want more. There's very little for people without at least a high school education to be doing. Even kind of fields that we've thought about as potentially offering a stable middle-class life in generations gone by, skilled trades, blue-collar work, those jobs either don't exist anymore for the most part or are much more technical and require higher levels of education and training. I think it's good to acknowledge progress where it's been made, but the job's not done. And I think anybody who looks at our report or looks at any number of communities around the country can see that even one student falling through the cracks is too many.
Michael, a final thought from you? Is this a good news story?
I was surprised by it because I'm in an epicenter, and I'm excited by it because it means that the expectations, I think, have increased, and the issue is we have more awareness over the issue of dropouts because it is an economy issue. It is something we need to focus on. But in those epicenters, I think everybody needs to do what they can to, as we call it, chase kids back and reengage them in their education.
Michael Aron is principal and founder of Learning Works. That's a charter school in the Pasadena area that works to get kids who've dropped out of school back into school. She's also recently elected to the Pasadena Unified School District Board. She was with us from KPCC in California. Here in Washington, D.C., Chris Swanson, he's vice president of Editorial Projects in Education. Thank you both so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's hard being a modern dad, especially when your kid does something like this.
He had gone onto Facebook and used an alias, made his age to be 18, and he was chatting with friends of his at school in the middle of the night.
Does father still know best? Our panel has been there and serves up some advice just in time for Father's Day. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.